It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For people of a certain age, it's become one of those "where were you when" questions. Wednesday was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of this nation's most famous civil rights leader, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The public response rippled across the country, including here in Pittsburgh. We're going to look back at the reaction in our region and also the lasting impact of Dr. King's words, actions, and accomplishments on our community. Joining us in studio, reporter Christian Morrow from the New Pittsburgh Courier. Welcome, Chris. And Steve Millen, multimedia journalist with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome to you as well, Steve. You have both reported extensively on what transpired in Pittsburgh when the news came out about Dr. King's murder. First of all, I want to get an image that may be formed in your minds from the memories of those you talked to. What picture did that create for you from those reflections? Steve, let's start with you.
Well, we talked to about 24 people for the story that we published in the Post-Gazette on Sunday. And the people that we talked to had very clear memories of where they were when they heard the news of Dr. King's assassination. We had people who were – it was Thursday night, Thursday night of the month. Right. So there were a lot of people in meetings at the time. The NAACP was meeting downtown. They heard the news, and, of course, they were shocked and dismayed. There was anger. Dominica Howe is one of the people we talked to. She was part of a newly formed group called Black Sisters United in 1968. So this is an area of increased black consciousness. Mm-hmm. And they're meeting in the basement of a friend's house on North mm-hmm. Lang Avenue.
Right.
And the brother of one of the people in the meeting calls from the top of the steps. Right. Guess what, guys? Dr. King just got killed. They didn't believe him.
Yeah,
they said, "Don't joke with us. That's too. Don't even joke about that."
Yeah.
Well, he keeps calling. Finally, the young women march up the steps and they stand around the TV and they watch. They hear those reports. They watch the reports, and they have the same experience. They're shocked and dismayed. There's a lot of anger there. Richard yeah. Gilchrist is a. He's at the Civic Arena.
Urban Youth Action. Yeah, I want to get into some of the more detail about some of those specific reflections. Chris, what was the image that formed in your mind as people are, you know, recalling their memories, you know, and reflecting on that night when they learned?
Well, again, shock was obviously the first reaction, and people and disbelief. Yeah, people didn't really believe it at first, but then once it set in. And most of the folks I spoke with talked more about the aftermath mm-hmm. of how long it took before the anger started to boil. And
so it was shock followed by anger.
Yeah.
So there was some sort of
fairly quickly.
There.
According to Hop Kendrick, it took from the time he walked from a meeting on Wiley Avenue down to Center Avenue
now, remind us
for an
Hop
angry
Kendrick
crowd together.
Yeah. Hop Kendrick was became a committee man, I believe.
Exactly.
But he was a police officer at the time?
At the time, yeah, he was a county detective.
Okay.
And he was at a meeting up on Wiley Avenue when he heard the news. And by the time he'd gotten to Center, two blocks away, there was a crowd gathered, and they were not happy.
Okay, so, Steve, you mentioned in the story that you did with your colleague Julian Routh, by the way, you mentioned a 17-year-old. You sort of start with him, and he's waiting for a bus, and he doesn't know what's going on, and he's basically shooed away or whatever by a police officer.
This is Frank Sissel, a gentleman we met in working in the Strip District. He was 17 years old at the time, 17-year-old kid, and he had been visiting a friend of his on Colwell Street. And they spent the day listening to 45 RPM records, a stack of 45s in the basement of their home. And he was into Motown. That was big at the time. Martha and the Vandellas, Sam, all these things. And he emerges. He's been kind of insulated from the news of the day. And he walks from Colwell Street down Center Avenue. Center Avenue at the time is lined with businesses, bars. It's kind of
right. There's very busy.
Very busy. He walks down. He stands at the what's now Freedom Corner waiting on a bus. And a police car pulls up. And they tell him to move it. And he's like, I'm waiting for my bus. Frank is from McKees Rocks. So he's catching a bus downtown. He's going to catch another bus over to McKees Rocks. he doesn't understand. They tell him, your bus isn't coming, get moving. And Frank is kind of confused, so he pauses for a second. And in an instant, a police officer is out of the car, and Frank feels something whack up against the side of his head. It's a nightstick. So he staggers on down. Blood now is pouring down to the side of his head. He takes his shirt off to staunch the blood. But he staggers on down Center Avenue. He does not know what's happened, until he reaches downtown. Now, once he gets downtown, there are people in the streets. They're saying, can you believe what happened? He finally hears that Dr.
And he still doesn't know.
He still doesn't know. Finally, somebody tells him. He hears that Dr. King has been shot. And then he puts two and two together, that the police up in the hill were tense, and they were afraid something was going to happen. And so he eventually makes his way down to what the Jenkins Arcade downtown, and
hops
on the bus,
yeah,
and goes home.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Okay. So, Chris, you start your story. You mentioned a moment or so ago that it was shock and then followed by anger and all that. I believe you start your report with some incidents of violence, if you would. Regarding, you know, there was concern that a fire was set and that there were people living above in the upper stories.
Oh, yeah, that was another. There were folks who were the consensus from people like Alma Speed Fox.
And, Pittsburgh's own icon when it comes to civil rights.
She went through all of it. And Dr. Ralph Proctor, who's over at CCAC now, were that a lot of the fires and a lot of the vandalism and a lot of the looting, a lot of it was personal vendettas.
Okay.
It was, King's death was a wonderful excuse to make good on these. And some of the folks in the hill were not happy with some of the merchants, and they wanted to burn out this one store. And the owners, who had been there for years, old family, said, please, you know, take what you want, you know, just don't burn anything. And so they took what they wanted, and then they burned it. And there were multiple instances like that. I don't know how much of it was vendetta, how much of it was just anger at decades and decades of abuse, frankly, not being able to go to the swimming pool, not being able to shop downtown, not being able to go to the hotels.
A tipping point.
It was just, you know, the final straw.
You mentioned Ralph Proctor. I believe both of you talked to Ralph Proctor, college professor. You mentioned CCAC now, I believe formerly of Pitt. Steve, I believe there was a sort of a civil rights meeting. Was that the day after? And people were talking about, what do we do now? Mm-hmm. Not how did we react, but I mean, this is more of a now a thought out, how do we react? What do we do?
This was Ralph described to me of getting up on he at the time he lived in Squirrel Hill. He grew up in the Hill District, lived at Squirrel Hill at the time. He gets up the next morning because he wants to know what's going to happen. So he drives on down Center Avenue and he parks. He goes to the Halfway Art Gallery, which is kind of a hangout for members in the movement at the time. There's no one there. He checks the NAACP office. No one there. He finally ends up. Somebody says, you got to go to Ebenezer. He walks into Ebenezer Baptist Church up on Wiley Avenue, and his eyes take a second to adjust to the light. And he walks into this extraordinary meeting of a couple hundred. It's just like everybody who's been involved in the movement is at this meeting. And it's extraordinary in that these are groups that normally would not talk to each other and didn't agree with each other. The young militants, Alma Speed Fox, Bird Brown, members of the more conservative NAACP.
Longtime attorney in the Pittsburgh area, yes.
Right. And there's this day-long meeting that takes place where they're trying to figure out what the response should be. How should we respond as a community? Some people thought we need to do something that's reflective of King's legacy of nonviolence. And others are like, this is it. We had one nonviolent member and they killed him, so let's burn the place down.
Yeah, exactly. You have a quote in there. They killed the most nonviolent member of the movement. Let's burn the damn place down.
Yep.
Yeah. Did you get that sort of range of reactions too in your reporting, Chris?
Not so much, because most of the folks I talked to were of the more conservative element. I didn't really talk to anybody who was a militant at the time. I probably should have. Ralph did mention that meeting, and he said it was odd that he'd never seen all of those people in the same room at the same time and being civil.
So I want to get to Dr. King's legacy and impact on the Pittsburgh region. Some cities, can you assess how Pittsburgh responded as a whole in terms of what violence there might have been compared to other cities? Were we pretty much contained or not? What would you say?
Well, you know, there was a lot of discussion up to 1968. I mean, you have to consider the year before there were more than 150 riots in other cities, the worst being Detroit, Newark. I think the total between those two cities, 80 people dead from those riots. Most of those people were in the African-American community who died. It had devastating impact on those cities. And yet Pittsburgh remained calm, relatively speaking. And I remember Salah Uddin telling me when I was doing the research for this, he said there was some talk in civil rights movements. You guys in Pittsburgh haven't done anything yet. And if you're not going to riot in the aftermath of King's death, you're never going to riot in history. And do you lack the guts or the consciousness to rise up? It's kind of interesting because the language that was used, we started off asking about the riots. We were corrected by many people who said, no, this was an uprising. It was a rebellion. It was an insurrection. It was people rising up from decades of poor housing, lack of decent jobs, lack of a decent education. You had the demolition of the cultural center of a vibrant African-American community when the Hill District was bulldozed in the late 50s. Right. All that boiled up, and the trigger point was the King assassination, 1968.
Yeah, in our remaining 2 minutes, I want to get your thoughts. So you talk to these people who are already becoming leaders in the community and have maintained that leadership through the years, through the decades. Where there might have been sorrow on their faces when you talked about that night, that day in the media. Is there sort of a smile when you talk about, in a sense today, or at least the impact of Dr. King on the Pittsburgh area, on the positive the positive impact that his legacy has had? We'll start with you, Chris. We have about 2 minutes left.
In the sense that there was still a lot of frustration because, you know, after King's death and the burnings and the lootings, the investment never came back to the black community. Mm-hmm. The Hill District was, you know, no money came back in there. Same thing out in the East End. But we're starting to see that rebuilding now, slowly but surely. And Bill Strickland, who pretty much rebuilt Manchester by himself, said, you know, he remembers this vividly, the tanks on mm-hmm. Manchester, in Manchester. And he said, there needs to be a greater determination to live up to his dream than now than ever.
Steve, 45 seconds left. In talking to these leaders, I mean, did you talk about today, what their feelings are, reflecting on the overall impact of Dr. King? About 40 seconds.
Well, one of the things that Tim Stevens told me is that a lot of the leaders of the movement that we see today, a lot of people involved in the community and making life better, that fire in the belly came about
exactly
in the aftermath, and those days after, they saw something needs to be done. It needs to be constructive. The Black Action Society at the University of Pittsburgh is a perfect example. Curtis Porter looked down there, and a lot of his classmates, they met the night that Dr. King died, and they said, we have to do something, and we have to be results oriented. And you can go to Pitt today and look at the diversity on that campus and the offerings on that campus. Direct result of those young students in their early 20s resolving that night to make positive change.
Steve Mellon's a multimedia journalist with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Christian Morrow's a reporter from the New Pittsburgh Courier. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, a less experienced police force for the city of Pittsburgh. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pirate Parrot debuts at Three Rivers Stadium in 1979. The parrot hatched on April 1st, the same year the Bucks went on to win the World Series. He was introduced following the success of the Philly Fanatic and based on the fictional Captain Flint from the adventure story Treasure Island. According to his official biography, he hopes to someday be inducted into the Mascot Hall of Fame. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for April 6, 2018.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For decades, the city of Pittsburgh has struggled with the diversity of its police force, prompting a hiring quota that was in place for 16 years. But now the Bureau might have a different kind of challenge. Data shows the current force is less experienced as a whole. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Shelley Bradbury has dug into those numbers. She joins us in studio. Welcome, Shelley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you found out that over the last 5 years, the average amount of experience has dropped significantly. How much and what's behind those figures?
We did an analysis of the hire dates of the officers in 2012 and in 2017. And we found that over the last 5 years, the median level of experience dropped from 17 years per officer down to about 12 and a half years per officer. So what that means is that in 2012, half of the force, about half of the force, had more than 17 years of experience. And now about half the force has 12 or more years of experience. So on the flip side, half the force has fewer than 12 years of experience.
So the average length of experience seems to be affected by the number of officers who are relatively new on the job, 5 years and less experience, it seems like.
Yeah, the biggest bulk of officers now, if you break them down by five-year segments, are in that 0 to 5 year start of their career level.
What have you heard from the officers themselves, longtime veterans, even some who have retired, or those maybe much newer on the beat?
Yeah, there's a mix of opinions about whether this lack of experience or lessening of experience is a good or bad thing for the force. And I think really it's a little bit of both. Some of the older officers worry that there's not much street-level officer experience, so there are fewer experienced officers at the street level. And when I say experience, like 7 to 12 years of experience on the street.
Are they retiring? Are they just retiring from this force, putting in their years to get a pension, and then moving off and joining other police departments?
Yeah, so it seems like officers leave kind of at two different areas. One is in their first couple years. So they come in to the Pittsburgh Police Academy. They get trained, which is really good training. They get a couple of years on the force. They get their feet under them. And then they might leave for a job in a suburb or in a nearby county, which typically pays more than the city of Pittsburgh pays their police officers.
I want to ask you, any sense that the suburban job is maybe less stressful, maybe a little bit safer?
It certainly would be fair to say that it is less stressful and probably a little bit more routine. Officers in Pittsburgh tend to deal with a wider range of things, and they tend to deal with it more frequently than, say, a quieter small town.
Any particular suburban police departments really good at poaching city officers?
You know, that's interesting. I looked at the Bethel Park Police Department, and they have 9 of their 37 officers came from Pittsburgh police, including their police chief out there, Tim O'Connor. And he said it's really great when he can get Pittsburgh police officers because they come in, they're well-trained, they already know what they're doing.
I want to get a little bit into the, shall we call it, double-dipping. Is there anything to stop a city retiree with still plenty of physical stamina for a second career from collecting his or her city pension and moving on to another department?
No. In fact, that happens pretty frequently, and it's a smart financial decision for the officer because, you know, obviously you can rack up a second pension that's going to help you when you're retiring. But no, there's nothing to stop an officer from putting in 20 years at Pittsburgh PD, qualifying for the pension, and then maybe being only 40 or 45 and then heading off and doing another 10 or 20 years somewhere else.
What about management? Is there concern by Chief Schubert or Public Safety Director Hisrick?
Chief Schubert really sees it as a positive, and there are several aspects that he pointed to, in particular officers being younger officers, perhaps being more technologically savvy, more malleable when it comes to training, and perhaps new community policing efforts. He really focused on the positives. Director Hisrick mentioned that he might be more concerned if the age, the median age dropped farther. So he was like, if we are down to 5 years of average experience, then I think we'll have an issue. But he was not as concerned with the 12 years of experience.
For your report, you spoke to both John Jay College's Dennis Kenny, as well as Beth Pittenger, executive director of the Citizen Police Review Board. What did they tell you about the policing style of the younger officers?
Yeah, so Dennis Kenny said that typically younger officers tend to work harder. He recently completed a study in which they found that younger officers had higher levels of fatigue, and they couldn't figure out why. They compared shifts and workload and everything was similar. The difference that they found was just simply the age. So he said younger officers tend to be a little more assertive, a little more aggressive, and as a result, they tend to get more tired and then make more mistakes than more experienced officers.
Define aggressive, because when it comes to police, that can be perceived as a negative.
Right. Dennis Kenny mentioned it more as like just a style, like a hustle, like a go-getter kind of a thing.
And what about Beth Pittenger?
Beth has been watching the police department for a long time in her job at the Citizen Police Review Board. And what she said is that the younger officers, they aren't a mess, was what she said. They seem to be getting their job done, and she hasn't seen any rise in complaints because of their age.
So we as a city, should we be concerned at all?
You know, I think it will be something to keep an eye on. I think at this point, since we haven't seen any dramatic rise in complaints and we haven't really seen any street-level significant misconduct based on years of experience, that there's no need for immediate concern. But I think it's a good thing for citizens to be watching and keeping note of as time passes.
Shelley Bradbury is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much, Shelley.
Thank you.
Victims of domestic violence often remain on constant alert about their own physical and mental well-being, and often that of their children as well. But those worries don't suspend everyday concerns about money, getting to work on time. This week, Mayor Bill Peduto issued an executive order that will eventually mean paid time off for city workers facing domestic violence. Post-Gazette reporter Adam Smeltz has been covering the story. Welcome back to the program, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, you can email us. That's confluence@wesa.fm, or tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Adam, so what's the situation currently? Do workers have to take sick days, vacation days when they're dealing with domestic violence?
Right now, they'll have their normal package of paid time off available to them, vacation time, personal time, sick time that they might take in a case like that. They also might be taking unpaid time off, which is a concern because, if you take too much unpaid time off,
you might lose your job.
Certainly could, raise that prospect.
Okay. Yeah. Now, according to data, you cite this in your story, from the National Partnership on Women and Girls and the City of Pittsburgh, the Peduto administration cited this, people who face intimate partner violence typically forfeit 7.2 days worth of work-related productivity. Job security, a reliable income, is vital for survivors trying to establish independence away from their abusers. So how much leave does the city plan to offer under this executive order?
That's in the works. The mayor has established a committee that over the next 3 months is going to be looking at questions exactly like that, that really get down into the details and into the weeds on this issue. In about 3 months or so, that commission should be emerging with a very specific, detailed, refined policy that will get into exactly how much time might be made available.
Who's going to be among this group, or at least what types of people will be on this committee, sort of ironing out those details?
Well, the city's Human Resources Commission is represented on the committee, or Human Resources Department, I should say, is represented on the committee. It also includes groups like the Women's Law Project here in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Action Against Rape, the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh, all of which joined the mayor for his announcement earlier this week.
In fact, I believe the leader of the Center and Shelter talked to you. You got an interesting comment from her. regarding that nature of the independence of the victims and job security and a reliable income is part of that.
Absolutely. And in a lot of these situations, women are setting out from their partners, separating from their partners, trying to establish new residences, new homes for themselves, for their kids, if kids are in the picture. And so they, I think the quote here from Cheryl Regan, president at the Women's Center and Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh, said, "We're all terrified of losing our jobs and losing our income as women try to escape these situations."
Victims can use the time that is proposed to secure protection from abuse orders, care for children, or pursue child custody. What about recovery maybe from injuries from that abuse, court dates when there's a criminal activity, or even finding new housing away from their abusers?
That's all very much within the spectrum of what the city is talking about. Mayor Bill Peduto mentioned as he laid out the array of ways that survivors of domestic violence might use this time, he said, care for themselves is a very important part of this. And certainly I imagine that would extend to court dates for themselves as well.
Additional paid leave. Any idea what this is going to cost the city?
Well, the director of human resources for the city, Janet Manuel, didn't put an exact number on it. She said she expects that the cost will be minimal. There's already a working assumption in the city that domestic violence and what it costs its survivors in terms of time already is already probably costing the city some money because people who have survived these situations are already taking that time away from their jobs, whether that's unpaid or in terms of their allotted paid time off. So there's probably almost certainly some expense to the city already in just kind of embedded in all of this.
Right. Okay. In our minute remaining, I wanted to ask you, this applies to about 600 non-unionized workers. What about union workers?
There are about 2,600 non-union workers who work. Union workers who work for the city of Pittsburgh.
Right.
They're all covered by individual collective bargaining right. agreements, and those agreements dictate all of the working conditions of their respective jobs. So for something like this to be added in, even if it's a benefit to them, would need to be negotiated as part of collective bargaining.
And very quickly, is there a time frame on this panel making the recommendations and then adopting this policy?
The policy should be written in about 3 months or so. I imagine we can probably expect it to be in place by the end of the year.
Very good. Adam Smeltz is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Adam, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, Pennsylvania farmers are facing more than their share of challenges to their economic well-being, including possible retaliation to tariffs. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WESA's Good Question series is driven by you, the listener, and we're answering what you've always wanted to know about Pittsburgh.
In cities like Pittsburgh, people use the freeways almost like a local road. They make very short trips to get to one interchange or another, and that's really not what they're designed for.
The Liberty Bridge did not go over the river and into the tunnel. Everything either went up McArdle Roadway or down McArdle Roadway into Southside or up into Mount Washington.
There's more online at wesa.fm/goodquestion.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania dairy farmers are in an economic bind thanks to a major drop in demand at the end of May. Plus, other Pennsylvania farmers face the threat of sanctions and retaliation for President Trump's trade tariffs. We're going to talk about the impact on farmers in western Pennsylvania with Daniel Moore, a business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
And for a look at how farmers are dealing around the country, we're pleased to welcome Frank Morris, senior editor and national correspondent for KCUR in Kansas City. Welcome to the program, Frank.
Hi, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, you can email us. That's theconfluence@wesa.fm or tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. This week, China announced it was imposing tariffs on American exports, including agricultural products. That comes in retaliation for the president's tariffs on Chinese goods. Frank, let's start with you. What's the general reaction from farmers in your region of the country or elsewhere? Are you hearing concern, fear, anger about this potential trade war? And what's the impact on them personally?
Well, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of impact so far. You know, there's sort of projected losses in a lot of cases. These are crops that haven't been sold. Some people are selling hogs at a lower price because of the sanctions. You know, the reaction, though, is fairly mixed. Farm groups are really up in arms, especially the soybean folks who export a lot to China. But some farmers will tell you, look, you know, Trump's a tough negotiator, and we think we've always come out ahead on these things in the end. So we think in the end, maybe we'll come out on top. Farmers know they're exposed because they are giant exporters. They're exporters in a country of importers, and so they're always something like 20% of all U.S. farm products are exported out of the country because farmers just grow too much to eat here, and so they realize they're going to be on the leading edge of this because they've benefited so much from global trade in the past.
Frank, briefly, some of the key specific agricultural products that are being targeted?
Well, you know, the big one, the big export to China is soybeans. China has a huge pork industry. They eat soybeans. And so one of the big ones, it's around $14 billion a year worth of soybeans head to China. And China can get those soybeans from South America, and they do. It's a seasonal thing, and they import them from the United States in the fall. So, you know, that's the big one. You know, pork's another pretty big export. A lot of U.S. pork parts and sort of parts of the pig that we don't normally eat here anyway, a lot of that goes to China. That's really important for the U.S. pork industry. But China is the world's largest pork producer, so it doesn't account for very much of their pork. So soybeans are the big one, and then, you know, you have dairy products, powdered milk and so forth going to China, and trees. You know, send a lot of lumber to China, tree nuts. In California, some of the crops there, almonds and pistachios, very high percentage of that crop goes to China.
Daniel, Pennsylvania, not affected as much, but affected to some if dairy products are involved, but also pork as well.
Yeah, it's really the prospect of there being tariffs on dairy products. And it's very real because, you know, House Speaker Paul Ryan is from Wisconsin, dairy farm country. But the fact of the matter is China really loves our cheese. They really like our dairy products. And exports have been a huge business for Pennsylvania dairy. Just looking at some numbers here. In 2016, $247 million in dairy exports from Pennsylvania alone, more than 6,000 dairy farms, 80 processing plants. So any kind of tariff on the dairy industry here in Pennsylvania would be drastic. And I haven't talked a lot about politics with dairy farmers, but the business over the last few years has been very, very bad. And so any additional pressure would be devastating.
Yeah. Pennsylvania might be surprising to some, is pretty high up there in dairy. Mm-hmm. It's sixth nationally in milk production. You mentioned cheese, seventh in cheese, second in butter production. So by the end of May, Dean Foods will sever ties with from Pennsylvania about 42 dairy farms after Walmart opted to open its own dairy plant. Daniel, how big of a deal is that for an entire region to lose one of its biggest buyers?
Well, it's a huge deal because you can't really have a dairy farm without having a contract with the buyer. And so what happened was Dean Foods is one of the largest food distributors in the country. It's based in Texas. It's been buying milk from Pennsylvania dairy farms for many years. And so for them to pull out at the end of May and to give dairy farms 2 or 3 months to really find a new buyer, It's a tough prospect. And the fact is the market is so oversupplied and flooded with milk that dairy farms have a hard time finding a new home. I mean, they're going to have to look at cheese plants, at other local processing plants. But the fact of the matter is Dean Foods was their buyer for so many years that they're going to have a hard time finding another one.
And plus, there's a national milk glut going on right now anyway.
There is, yeah.
Is that felt out in your part of the country, Frank, the milk glut?
Well, I mean, there are enormous dairies in the western part of Kansas. That's basically a desert. But there is a lot of corn grown out there from an aquifer. And so there are huge dairies out there. And there they're not exporting cheese or butter, but more like powdered milk, or these big powdered milk powdering plants. And so I don't know what percentage of that winds up going to China, but the dairy issue is very big in Kansas because of the way the dairy industry's changed and consolidated. I can't tell you how big of a dairy state Kansas is, but it's up there. And the lousy market for milk, the milk glut, and then the threat of these tariffs, these Chinese tariffs on milk, that's definitely an issue out here.
All right. Just a couple of minutes left. In the face of all this, both of you, is there anything farmers can do to protect their businesses? Daniel, let's start with you.
Well, I guess, a lot of the downturn in the market is due to consumers opting for other types of milk. People are drinking more alternative milks like coconut, soy, almond. Better promotion of why drinking dairy milk is a good thing for you, why you would want to drink dairy milk, eat ice cream, eat yogurt, eat cheese. But a lot of it really is driven by consumption of milk and the fact that dairy farms are producing way too much milk for what's being consumed.
Frank, in the Midwest, what can farmers do, if anything, or do they just have to throw up their hands and be the survivors that they are?
Farmers have a lot of, there are definitely groups looking to protect farmers. In the end, a lot of times taxpayers are going to be on the hook for some of this damage because of the way crop insurance works. If depending on what kind of crop insurance you have, you can be at least partially protected against man-made problems like a trade war. And so there are a lot of things farmers can do. They haven't planted their soybeans yet. They can adjust that. They can insure that crop in various ways with taxpayer-subsidized insurance. And so they can complain some of them are complaining pretty loudly to the leadership in Washington.
All right. We have about 40 seconds left, so 20 seconds for each of you. Are there potential ripple effects of tariffs and other shifts in agriculture on other industries? Quickly, Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, farm country up in Mercer County, Butler County, I mean, you see a lot of fertilizer plants, a lot of tractor dealers. I passed a veterinarian when I was driving around over there that, they do a lot of work on animals. And so really, if a dairy farm closes, there are so many industries and jobs and businesses that support that farm operating that if that pulls out of the market, I mean, all these supporting companies would go out too.
And Frank, potential ripple effects of tariffs out your way?
Well, steel and aluminum tariffs also affect farmers because they're big purchasers of equipment, which it was likely to go up. And all kinds of, they need pipes, they need all kinds of infrastructure too. So the farmers are potentially going to get hit both ways. They're going to lose money on their products and they're going to pay more for the things that they have to buy.
All righty. Frank Morris is senior editor and national correspondent for KCUR Public Radio in Kansas City. Daniel Moore is a business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Zakiya Madian. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.